Meanwhile, the website of the Electronic Intifada on the Zionist regime's settlers' attacks on Palestinian farmers wrote, "Feroz Youssef is taking all the precautions he can to fend off ever more aggressive settler attacks on his land west of Salfit in the occupied West Bank. The farmer, 37, has already seen his land, 30,000 square meters outside the town of Azavia, divided into two by Israeli regime separation wall, where it dips deep into the West Bank, southwest of Nablus, in the Salfit governorate. Never peaceful settlers from the nearby settlements of Ariel, Alei Zahav, Pudul, and Barkan have been acting even more aggressively over the past several months. Last year, according to the UN, Palestinians in the West Bank had to endure the highest recorded levels of settler violence in recent years. Fearing for his safety as well as his livelihood, Youssef has constructed a wooden hut on top of one of his bigger olive trees. The hut is about 5 meters squared and is built on the tree trunk, some 3 meters up. It is outfitted with plastic windows and boasts a sheet metal roof. A single solar panel provides electricity. Inside, there are chairs, covers, and bedding, enabling Youssef to stay overnight on his land. This serves two purposes. He can keep an eye on his land at night, and he is not subject to the capricious moods of Israeli troops at checkpoints to reach his land in the mornings. Youssef is by no means the only farmer to come up with this idea. He estimates that around 230 other local farmers have built huts on their lands for the same purpose. He fears, however, that the Israeli military might come and destroy the hut, as has happened to others. Settlers are wreaking havoc in small communities around the West Bank. Hardly a day goes by without some reports of cars being vandalized, civilians being assaulted, or trees being targeted. There are more than 280 settlements in the West Bank, outside of East Al-Quds. These are home to some 440,000 settlers, lured there by tax breaks and other financial incentives offered by the Zionist regime. Some 150 of these are so-called settlement outposts, attracting more extreme elements among the settlers. Some of these outposts are being legalized to become full settlements. A third of the outposts were established over the last decade. All pose a threat to the security of Palestinians in the vicinity, and the Zionist regime military is another source of danger for farmers and others. At least 26 children have been killed by troops or settlers this year alone. Most settler attacks take place in Area C. Some 60% of the occupied West Bank, which is under direct Israeli regime military and administrative control. Youssef Farm is in Area C, where the Zionist regime apartheid system is quite brazen. Israeli settlers are treated as civilians under Israeli law, while Palestinians like Youssef in the same area are subject to military rule. There is little to no protection for Palestinians in Area C or anywhere else. The military does not have the authority to intervene against settlers since they are seen as civilians. It is a fine distinction that B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights group, calls meaningless. Settler violence, the group holds, is a form of government policy, and troops almost never have to face any consequences for their actions. According to another Israeli rights group, Yesh Din, in the years 2019 and 2020, the Zionist regime military received a total of 273 complaints related to violations committed by troops against Palestinian civilians. Of these complaints, just 56 investigations were opened, or about a fifth of all complaints submitted. Yeshdin attributed the small number of opened investigations, a number that is decreasing year on year, to a deliberate policy to raise the threshold for opening criminal investigations. Ultimately, the group found only 2% of complaints resulted in prosecution. Ahmad Al-Mahmoud, 66, from Kafar al-Dik, further west from Salfit, suffers constant vandalism by settlers from the nearby Al-Izahaf settlement, to which he has already lost 6,000 square meters of his 13,000 square meters of land, now surrounded by a metal fence and off-limits to him. Murad Shetvi, head of the Colonization and Wall Resistance Commission of the Northern West Bank and a coordinator for unarmed resistance marches, told the Electronic Intifada that settlements have led to the confiscation of thousands of dhonams of agricultural land in the Salfit Governorate. The entire area of the governorate is about 26,000 dhonams, Shetvi said, with 11,000 located in Area A, and under the Palestinian Authority, and 15,000 dhonams are in Area C. A dhonam is equivalent of 1,000 square meters. Salfit Governorate contains 25 Israeli settlements, Shetvi added, the largest of which is Ariel, which is built on land belonging to the villages of the area, including Kafar al-Dik and al-Zawiya. The most dangerous settlement project in Salfit is the occupation's attempt to expand the Ariel settlement by establishing an industrial zone there and linking it to a settlement that is being planned in the Ras area and Khalat Hassan area west of Salfit. Ahmad al-Mahmoud also built a hut on his land. In fact, it was built several times because the Israeli regime military kept demolishing it. The latest demolition was in September 2020. He rebuilt it less than 2 months later. Today, the hut is multifunctional, including as a recreational place for his family and grandchildren. Settler attacks increase more during the harvest seasons, al-Mahmoud told the Electronic Intifada, adding, especially the olive harvest. Settler gangs prepare themselves for the September-November harvest by cutting down olive trees and stealing their fruits. And it is not just Palestinians who are targets. Settlers have been known to target foreign and Israeli activists when these have turned up to protect farmers for the harvest, pelting them with stones or assaulting them with clubs. Al-Mahmoud does not only have to contend with direct assaults, he told the Electronic Intifada. When the Zionist regime in administrative control over the area, he has yet to receive permission to dig a water well for irrigation purposes. He still has to rely on trucks carrying water tanks to irrigate his trees once a week.
Aperture. Dow Chemical and DuPont are American chemical corporations. These two chemical giants have become the number one companies in the chemical sector. Today, they make billions of euros in profit. But behind this resounding success lies a dark secret: toxic contamination and pollution, which has affected thousands, causing disabilities, cancers, and even death. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. For decades, Dow Chemical and DuPont factories have been secretly dumping their toxic waste into rivers, groundwater systems, and soil, and keeping the tragic consequences a secret. Sadly, the constant exposure to toxic waste spares no one, neither surrounding residents nor the company's employees. Stay with us as this week's documentary sheds light over years of lies and impunity through the analysis of samples in confidential documents.
At the end of the 60s, Leotis Jones was a prisoner in Holmesburg, a suburb of Philadelphia in the United States. A prisoner, but also a guinea pig for industry, like thousands of other inmates.
H-block, this is where all the medical testing, the human experimentation was going on.
How many times have you taken that corridor?
Oh, man, about maybe 25, 30 times. You know, but there was different tests that they was running. And sometimes I was on like two tests at a time, you know?
Okay.
This practice was confidential at the time, because multinational chemical companies came here to test the risks of their products. To earn a few dollars, the prisoners participated in several tests, but none of them knew what they were being given.
What they would do, they would put the tape and stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it, stick it and pull it. Then they would put a drop in the substance, whatever it was that was in it, on that area.
And what happened after?
All over my body, my skin pigmentation got light in certain areas.
How long did it last?
About a year, somewhere around there. And they had you signing a paper stating that it was informed consent, but it was just a paper to waive them from being liable if anything go wrong.
One company did everything they could to keep this a secret. They even paid Leotis Jones for his silence. Dow Chemical. The leading manufacturer of plastics in the world and the third largest manufacturer of pesticides, Dow Chemical has an annual turnover of $48 billion and 50,000 employees around the globe. In the wake of this chemical giant, there's an industry of staggering profitability, an industry in a frantic race to innovate. Each year, their new toxic products reach the market. These multinationals all have one thing in common: a culture of secrecy.
You're following us.
Polluting lands, rivers, and groundwater. Behind the fumes of these factories, we have discovered tens of thousands of victims. In India, children are born with severe disabilities. In the U.S., those who have dedicated their lives to this industry...
Everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and it was secure.
...are now paying the price.
Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. Why'd they lie?
Faced with these tragedies, the chemical giants have adopted a specific course of action. Lack of transparency, cynicism, denial. In the meantime, they continue to reap the profits. In Holmesburg Prison, Dow experimented on the inmates with one of the most carcinogenic products in the world, dioxin. It's one of the molecules in Agent Orange, the powerful herbicide that Dow produced for the American Army during the Vietnam War. The Air Force dumped it on the Viet Cong for a decade. At the same time, the tests were being performed at Holmesburg. From that time on, Dow was already aware of the dangers of dioxin. The company put it in writing in this confidential note from June 1965. Dioxin is exceptionally toxic. Some months later, Dow would study its side effects on the prisoners.
Hey, man, what can I say?
There's no way in the world if they would have informed us back then that we would participate. No, I wouldn't have. They were trying to cover it up. They wouldn't invite it up.
We found one of the doctors that performed the tests at Holmesburg in the 1960s. Today, he's an oncologist at Northwestern Hospital in Chicago. Sigmund Weitzman is preparing to retire. He is one of the few witnesses still alive.
Every day, I had a row of 20 convicts. They were coming in all day. Okay. So
all day long, people were coming
in? Oh, absolutely. It was a machine.
In 1967, Sigmund Weitzman was only 21 years old. He was an intern at Holmesburg. The senior physician overseeing the tests never told him the names of the products used on the prisoners. He only realized later that he had administered dioxin to human beings. We show him what Dow knew back then about the chemical.
This material is exceptionally toxic. No wonder it's confidential. This is 50 years old.
Yeah.
It's very upsetting.
This is the first time you read these documents?
Yes.
I'm
appalled. I'm just very... It's so casual. I also felt personally guilty that I was participating in something so horrible. You don't give people poison. It's just simple. You know, as if these people aren't people. They're just experimental animals. Nowadays, it would be criminal.
Dow was never prosecuted. When prisoners tried to take action against the company, the statute of limitations had expired. This multinational would not only poison inmates with dioxin, but also tens of thousands of people in Midland, Michigan, in the north of the U.S. Midland, the birthplace of Dow.
Here at the Dow Chemical Company in Midland, Michigan, revolutionary chemical killers.
This is where Agent Orange was manufactured. Its production created waste extremely high in dioxin. Dow secretly dumped this waste into the river that flows through the city. In 1981, one man would discover the truth.
We had a conclusion there that Dow was a major source, if not the only source, to the river, and certainly to the community, and that people were at risk.
At the time, Milton Clark was a toxicologist for the EPA, the government agency responsible for environmental protection. With his colleagues, he wrote a report condemning Dow's practices. But right before the report's publication, the corporation would succeed in pressuring the acting chief of the EPA in Washington. Pressured by his superiors, Milton Clark was forced to censor the report. The result? Pollution in Midland, Michigan would continue for 30 years with impunity. And the executives at Dow would continue denying the dangers.
There is no health problem in Midland. There is absolutely no evidence of dioxin doing any damage to humans.
In 2006, one woman would attack the multinational again. At the time,
Mary Gade oversaw all the offices at the Environmental Agency in the Midland region. She had leverage. She'd been nominated by the President of the United States, George W. Bush. Newly appointed, she demands that more testing be done in the city.
We found these astronomically high levels of dioxin, levels that my staff think may be some of the highest levels ever found in the United States. One of the things that was astonishing to me when this came to my attention was that for almost 30 years, this very serious problem had not actually been addressed.
Where have you found these high levels?
So yeah, we found it in yards alongside the river system, parks where children play, where people launch their boats, where fishermen put their boats in the water. This is where people live. So I immediately called Dow senior officials and said, we're very concerned about these levels. We need you to take action. As that unfolded, the company was not happy. It's extremely expensive to clean up this much contamination, mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of dollars, if not more.
To lodge a complaint, Dow goes directly to the White House.
I was asked on May 1st of 2008 to either resign or quit by the end of the day.
Okay. Were you surprised?
Yes, very much so. In my 30-some years of working in environmental protection and much of that spent in the government, I would have never expected that. Dow was acting in its own interests, so Dow was trying to make sure that it saved as much money as possible.
As a result of these maneuvers, for decades, thousands of people have lived surrounded by dioxin without knowing the risks. We wanted to meet these victims. But in Midland, it's hard to loosen tongues. Dow has supported the city for 120 years, and reminders are at every corner. At the bank, the stadium, the library, the public park, the high school. The shadow of the company is everywhere. Only one person agreed to break the code of silence. Alice Buchelter has spent most of her life here, near the river. This is where she raised her family.
We used to have all trails that went down through here. I don't even know if you can see any of them over here. But 18 years and the land is very fertile. And it was used for motocross trails and hiking trails and dune buggy trails and just, you know, recreation in the woods. For a kid, it was like a wonderland. It was, you know, an adventure. They could explore and they could build forts and they could do all those things.
No one advised you that there was dioxin down there?
Nope. We just thought we found a magical spot for us to play and raise a family.
For nearly 40 years, the Buchelter family would live here, blissfully unaware of their toxic surroundings. Every spring, the river floods their garden, bringing in a fresh wave of dioxin. Alice Buchelter would not discover the true extent of the contamination until 2007, when tests were conducted in her garden by the local environmental agency. The levels of dioxin were up to 17 times higher than the legal limit for toxicity.
My oldest daughter has autoimmune diseases.
You have five kids?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them do have autoimmune disease?
I would say all of them. Some to a lesser degree and some to a more severe degree. And my husband had a very malignant colon cancer. It was a real quick onset.
Her late husband, Herbert Buchelter, was a doctor. A few days before he passed away, he expressed a last wish.
He was brave enough to, when he was dying, to have his blood drawn when he didn't have very much blood left. Dioxin levels were taken the Thursday before he died on a Sunday. He was willing to do it to ascertain that there was a connection. The results of my husband's, this is his levels.
These are the actual breakdown.
Alex Buchelter's husband had 64.5 nanograms of dioxin per liter of blood, three times the U.S. average.
We had been married 46 years when he died. And would I have treasured 10 more years? Yeah. And, you know, that's been a major impact on my life.
The American Environmental Agency has finally forced Dow to clean the river. But the process has only just begun. It could take decades and cost hundreds of millions of dollars. However, no date is set for decontaminating neighboring yards like Alice Buchelter's. Dow refused all our requests for an interview. The multinational merely sent us an email stating that we seek science-based solutions that protect human health while also contributing to the well-being of the local community. On the other side of the world, another contamination is wreaking havoc. As a result of one of the worst industrial catastrophes in history, thousands of children have been affected. But Dow has never dealt with it. It happened in India, in Bhopal. In 1984, the local chemical plant exploded, killing 20,000 people and releasing tons of toxic products. At the time, the factory belonged to Union Carbide, a pesticide giant that Dow would buy up in 2001. The site of the Bhopal explosion is still saturated with chemical pollution. Over the years, these products have spread into the city's groundwater systems. For 15 years, the inhabitants have demanded a full decontamination. In vain, Dow refuses to act. The decaying steel site is still accessible today. Here we meet Mr. Shuan, a former engineer. At the time, he was in charge of the storage of the chemicals in this laboratory.
There's so many chemicals still remaining in this quality control lab. Very few bottles are now at present. But after the disaster, this quality control lab was full of the chemicals, bottle, drums, and after 32 years, still they are lying.
Is that dangerous?
Yeah, it is dangerous because there's no proper care of these premises.
Among the products stored in the factory, there was lindane, an extremely toxic insecticide. Today it is forbidden all over the world. According to our guide, the soil surrounding the factory is full of it.
The whole area is highly contaminated. They are dumping all toxic waste effluent on the ground. Right now you can feel the smell of the benzene hexachloride on this spot. And it is dangerous to stay here for a long period.
Benzene hexachloride is the scientific name for lindane. We go down to the area of the spill to take some samples. The smell is unbearable. We'll have the soil analyzed. Just before leaving, Mr. Schwan shows us where the pesticides were made. Beads of mercury lie exposed in the open air. According to the World Health Organization, this is one of the top 10 most dangerous chemical products in the world. We take some more samples. The results of our two tests are astonishing. Inside the factory, the level of mercury is 5 million times higher than the environmental standard. At this level of concentration, the risks of developing liver, skin, or lung cancers are considerable. The levels of lindane are just as alarming, exceeding 100,000 times the standard level. This can provoke severe cases of cerebral degeneration. Yet only 20 meters away, we see children playing cricket on the contaminated ground. The chemical contamination stretches far beyond the walls of the factory. Toxic waste has penetrated the land and has polluted the water of many neighborhoods. Up to 3 kilometers from the factory, 50,000 people live there. We went to take water samples to identify the molecules present in their wells, like in Shakya's family home. They've lived in this house for almost 30 years. The water they consume contains 1.9 micrograms of mercury per liter, 2 times the standard level of toxicity. The problem is, even in boiled water, mercury is still carcinogenic. In other areas of Bhopal, it's not mercury, but lindane that wreaks havoc on human lives. This is a problem in Preetnagar, a neighborhood situated 1 kilometer away from the factory. The municipality has had drinkable water since 2011, but for many years, the inhabitants have been drinking severely polluted water. That's the case for Rukmani and her 13-year-old daughter, Rachna. Since her birth, she's suffered from limited mental development and muscular dystrophy. She can neither talk nor stand up by herself. Rukmani, her mother, drank contaminated water every day during her pregnancy. A few months after Rachna's birth, a governmental study was conducted in the area. The levels of lindane were extremely high in the water, 17 times the World Health Organization limit. Due to her disabilities, Rachna has never been able to go to school. Every day she comes to the Shingari Rehabilitation Center. Without these daily exercises, she would be completely paralyzed today. Rashida B. is the founder of the center. She has watched all these children grow up.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The United States is the only large wealthy country in the world that doesn't have universal health care. The US healthcare system ranks last among high-income countries. After the news about the recent drop in US life expectancy, a new survey has found that 56% of the US public believe healthcare in general is handled not too well, or not at all well. Now we have taken a look at the world's media on this issue. Please stay with us. A new survey data released recently has shown that about 12% of the American public think healthcare in the United States is handled extremely or very well. Further evidence of the deep unpopularity of a profit-driven healthcare system that has left roughly 30 million Americans without insurance coverage and contributed to the country's stunning decline in life expectancy. The new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll finds that 56% of the American public believe healthcare in general is handled not too well or not at all well, while only 32% believe healthcare is handled somewhat well. In all, just 1 in 10 Americans, or 10%, feel the U.S. healthcare system as a whole and healthcare for older adults are handled well or extremely well. The opinion poll reveals that public satisfaction with the US healthcare system is remarkably low, with fewer than half of the American public saying it is generally handled well, according to an Associated Press report. The opinion poll shows an overwhelming majority of the American public, nearly 8 in 10, or 80%, say they're at least moderately concerned about getting access to quality healthcare in the United States when they need it. Survey results will come as no surprise to those who have attempted to navigate the Byzantine U.S. healthcare system to obtain basic care, which often comes at such prohibitively high costs that millions of people each year are forced to skip medical treatment to avoid financial ruin as insurance giants and pharmaceutical companies rake off huge profits. The Associated Press NORC findings, based on interviews with 1,505 individuals, U.S. adults, between 28th of July and 1st of August 2022, shows that just 6% of the American public feel prescription drug costs are handled well or extremely well in the U.S., where pharmaceutical firms have broad authority to set prices as they please. As for potential solutions to the country's long-standing healthcare crisis, the new opinion poll shows that about two-thirds of American adults think it is the federal government's responsibility to make sure that all Americans have healthcare insurance coverage, with adults aged between 18 and 49 more likely than those aged over 50 to hold that view. The percentage of people who believe healthcare coverage is a government responsibility has risen in recent years, ticking up from 57% in 2019 and 62% in 2017, according to the Associated Press. More specifically, the opinion survey shows 40% of the American public support a single-payer healthcare system that would require Americans to get their health insurance from a government plan. Depending on how the question is framed and phrased, single-payer, more commonly called Medicare for All, has polled as high as 70% support. According to the Associated Press NORC survey, 58% of the American public say they favor a government healthcare insurance plan that anyone can purchase, a public option. Recent research shows that a Medicare for All system of the kind proposed in new legislation introduced by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Pramila Jayapal, a Democrat from Washington, could have prevented hundreds of thousands of COVID-19 deaths in the United States over the past 2 years. In the richest country in the world, no one should die or go into debt just because they don't have access to health care. Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, tweeted last week. She added, "We need Medicare for All right now." According to Forbes, some 80% of the American public worry about how they will access good health care, according to a new Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research opinion poll, which found the vast majority of the American public are dissatisfied with the system in the United States, one of the only developed nations that doesn't offer universal health care insurance. People of color were more likely than white people to be concerned about accessing good health care in America, with 60% of the black and Hispanic adults concerned about access to health care, compared to 44% of the white population. Some two-thirds of Americans believe it is up to the federal government to ensure people have health care, up from roughly 57% in 2019, according to the survey. But only 40% of the American public say they want a single-payer healthcare system that would mandate Americans get health insurance from the government. More, or 58%, would prefer a government healthcare plan that would be available for anyone to buy, according to the opinion poll. Americans gave an even worse review of how the U.S. handles prescription drug costs, mental health care, and nursing homes. Only 6% of the American public, or even fewer, said they were very satisfied with those services, according to the new opinion poll. 31.6 million Americans, that's how many people didn't have health care insurance in 2020. During the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, or nearly 10% of all Americans, according to a survey from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. The United States ranks the lowest among the wealthiest nations for its healthcare system, primarily due to a lack of affordability, despite spending the largest percentage of its gross domestic product, or GDP, about 19% of its GDP in 2020, on healthcare services, according to reports. It is one of the only wealthy nations lacking universal healthcare coverage, with the average American spending about $12,500 per person on healthcare costs in 2020.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. If God wishes to grant forgiveness to someone, this means healing the wound he inflicted on his own soul through sinning. So these true believers are those whose spiritual wounds God will heal, forgiveness in a noble provision. They shall have a provision without any abasement or humiliation, without any difficulty or grief. This is the kind of provision God will grant them. Whenever a faithful society comes into being, I am not talking about an individual, so do not say, "Thank God we have a morsel of bread to eat, so we are okay, we have no grief." Because when you really examine such a person's behavior, you see it is all misfortune and mistreatment of others. They do degrading work and they don't even see that what they do is degrading, or that this morsel of bread they have is a morsel of humiliation. I am talking about a society, when a society's morsel of bread is clean, when it is noble, when it is earned with dignity. This is when its provision is noble and distinguished, and this happens when a society is truly faithful and displays the qualities I am describing. If this was the case, all of the slogans that political parties in the world today are loudly proclaiming from every quarter to every people, whether truly or falsely, in order to win votes, all of these slogans and promises could be achieved in a truly faithful society. Peace, freedom, prosperity, and ease, achieved without war, without bloodshed, through fraternity, through friendship, a high level of culture, a high level of prosperity, and a high level of living, all of these slogans and mottos, some of which are meaningful, others of which are meaningless, all of them would be actually achieved in a faithful society and a noble provision.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Faith based on understanding. Saturday, the 4th of Ramadan, 1394, 21st of September, 1974. Indeed, in the creation of the heavens and the earth and the alternation of night and day, there are signs for those who possess intellect. Those who remember Allah standing, sitting and lying on their sides and reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth and say, Our Lord, You have not created this in vain. Immaculate are You. Save us from the punishment of the fire. Surah Ali Imran, Surah number 3, verses 190 and 191. Today we will look at a few more verses on the topic of faith. There are a few points we must consider. Firstly, faith is one of the foremost qualities of God's prophets and the true believers who follow them. They have faith in their own message. This is the difference between divine leaders and the political leaders of today's world.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
A dark, cold winter awaits Britain with the strikes and chaos in major city centres as the new Prime Minister Liz Truss is unable to rein in the economic crisis. Even experts have warned that Truss is about to collapse under the dead weights of the British economy. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, While Liz Truss is the architect of her own troubles in the UK right now, it is the financial markets that possess the mechanisms which will ultimately bring her down. When they saw that the economic stability which they carve and on which their profits depend was threatened by her pre-posterious policies, they acted to protect themselves. If that meant possibly bringing down an outspoken devotee of free market capitalism, then so be it. Capitalism doesn't care about the sovereignty of any state. It doesn't care about individuals, their intentions or philosophies, or even the well-being of millions of people who are hopelessly dependent on their nation's economy. In the great capitalist schemes of things, capitalism doesn't care about any of that beyond the simple extent to which these things can serve capitalism. Truss, in office barely 6 weeks, has caused a period of financial tumult with a controversial mini-budget, which included unfunded tax cuts, undermining confidence in her government and the UK's currency. Last week, she sacrificed her chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, in office for barely 38 days. She sacked him for implementing the very fiscal measures central to her economic strategy. She also reversed several key measures that were fundamental to that strategy. Why? Because the markets told her to. The market's response to the mini-budget caused sterling to nosedive, pension funds to panic, banks to high mortgage interest rates for millions of householders, and the Bank of England to pour in tens of billions of pounds worth of support. Truss responded by dumping Kwarteng and promising to retain a scheduled rise in corporation tax, which she had previously said she would scrap. To further steady investors' nerves, she also scrapped plans to abolish the UK's 45% higher tax rate, and she is proposing an increased tax take from energy companies, which sounds very like backtracking on a pledge she made to not introduce a windfall tax. Why? Because the markets told her to. Truss was forced to dismantle her radical plans. This is because the markets exerted their influence. They have forced significant U-turns and even cost a chancellor his job. Will it stop there, or will they also force a prime minister out of office? Unlike Margaret Thatcher, who famously declared herself a lady not for turning and on whom Truss rather embarrassingly styles herself, the current UK prime minister appears to be very much a lady for turning. Truss was prepared to cancel her government's economic plans just to appease the money markets. The financiers are back in control. Some might argue that a readiness to acknowledge one's errors is a measure of strength in anyone, especially a national leader. Some might argue that it shows that the interests of the country are that leader's central focus. But with Truss, this is more than outweighed by her stubborn refusal at the outset to listen to voices of caution before the measures were announced and implemented, even to the point of admitting the potential, even the certainty, for catastrophic damage and claiming it was a necessary collateral for policy to succeed. Yes, self-awareness and humility in a leader and the capacity to change course can be a great strength, but not if that is happening all the time. In Truss's case, it has happened continually in what should have been the honeymoon period of her premiership, in which she could have been given the opportunity to prove herself. Now, she has been backed into a corner and her only course of action is submission. The new Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, has already admitted that, contrary to Truss's original promises, there will be spending cuts to public services and tax rises. He has also declined to say whether he will honor Truss's pledges to increase defense spending to 3% of GDP and cut the basic rate of income tax for millions of people. He's doing what he thinks the markets want to hear and encourage confidence. Governments can be hostages to fortune, or more accurately, the blind economic forces of fortune hunters. 30 years ago, on a day that became known as Black Monday, speculators broke the pound by shorting the currency and making themselves billions. The markets don't care. Also, Crescent International Road. British Prime Minister Liz Truss's shoulders are too fragile to carry the weight of a sagging British economy. The pound sterling is sinking vis-a-vis the US dollar and may fall even lower against the greenback. Truss, however, is the architect of her own misfortune. Raw ambition blinded her to the reality that Britain is not only sick, but on its deathbed. Within a month of becoming Prime Minister, and after a grueling leadership contest in which she scrapped past Rishi Sunak, the Indian origin wonderkid of finance, reality has caught up with her. Truss does not have the competence to turn the British economy around. Being a female does not give her any advantage either. Truss dumped her finance minister Kwasi Kwarteng on October 14th, even though he followed her advice on cutting taxes to revive the economy. She essentially shifted blame for her policy to the ousted finance minister.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Another Palestinian young man, seen by many as a hero and an icon, has been killed by Israeli forces during a confrontation in the occupied West Bank. For more than 10 days, the regime's forces had been carrying out a manhunt for Uday Tamimi after he shot at an Israeli military checkpoint at the entrance to his hometown, the Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds. On Wednesday night, he was gunned down during clashes with Israeli forces at the entrance of an illegal settlement in eastern Al-Quds called Ma'ale Adumim. Hearing a call from Palestinian factions, a general strike has been held in Al-Quds and throughout the occupied West Bank to mourn at Tamimi. The walkout affected all public institutions and private sectors, including schools and businesses. Public transportation was also shut down during the strike.
The general strike prevailing today in the occupied territories is a political message that the Palestinian people are standing behind the resistance option and to assert that they are following the footprints of the martyrs until victory and freedom. It's a message that the Palestinian people will not stand with their hands cuffed in front of the Israeli crimes and that they have the right to resist the occupiers.
Palestinian resistance factions have also urged Palestinians to take to the streets to denounce At-Tamimi's killing and the aggression by the Israeli regime. Sporadic protests also erupted in several areas of the West Bank. Protesters said they would offer as many martyrs for the sake of Palestine's freedom while fighting the Israeli occupation. They added that more action is required to respond to Israeli atrocities.
We are united as Palestinian people. We continue to prove that we have a strength to sacrifice our souls. We are ready to go to direct confrontations to resist the Israeli forces. We stand united behind the resistance, behind the confrontations, behind the martyrs.
Israel's escalating repression during the last month is part of a larger operation to quell the growing Palestinian resistance, particularly armed resistance. Recently, many Palestinian youths are drawn to this kind of resistance, with the newly formed group of fighters known as the Lion's Den as an example. Many might question whether a new uprising against Israel is in the making here in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. While the Israeli military is escalating its crackdown against Palestinians and using excessive force to counter the Palestinian resistance,